Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. At least 82 people died over the last 4 years while living outside or in temporary shelters in Vermont. Each of those 82 people had a family, a childhood, a backstory, and some sort of hope or expectation for their future. 82 people. How do we know that number? Well, the state doesn't track the deaths of homeless people. Most states don't. So two journalists, one from Vermont Public and the other from 7 Days, did it themselves. They spent hours and days not only sifting through paperwork and death certificates, but also learning about some of the people who died and the others who are trying to prevent more deaths from happening. Later in the show, we'll be joined by these two reporters, Liam Elder Connors and Derek Brower. But first, we're going to listen to the audio documentary that Liam put together. On this wintry day, we'll get to know some of the people who lived and died while homeless in our region. After, we'll open our phone lines to hear your responses to these stories. But for now, as you listen, if you have a question or a reaction to what you're hearing, you can email it to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And I also want to note that what we're about to hear includes some adult themes and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please take care while listening. And with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Liam.
It was nearly 11 p.m. and the wind chill was below zero. Social workers Sarah Russell and Taylor Tebow pulled a city-owned 14-passenger bus into a desolate parking lot in downtown Burlington.
Are we going anywhere in particular right now?
We'll probably hit up the Marketplace parking garage. I don't remember what that street's called, but we're right behind Simon's, across from City Market.
The pair were on a mission to search the mostly empty streets for the homeless and offer them a ride to the city's emergency shelter 3.5 miles away. Debo stepped off the bus and spotted a group of people bundled in jackets and blankets huddled on the sidewalk.
Hi, everyone. We're here from the North Ave shelter, the warming shelter. Is anyone interested in staying tonight?
People nodded.
We have a bus, so is everyone wanting to... How many people are there right now?
The shelter, located at a community center in a residential neighborhood, can hold 100 people. There were cots, hot showers, food, and new clothes. But this wasn't a permanent place to stay. It's an emergency response, only open for 3 of the coldest nights of the winter so far.
The goal of this shelter is, like, to keep people alive.
Homeless Vermonters face many deadly risks, but no one in the state tracks how many have died or what kills them. A first-of-its-kind analysis by Vermont Public in 7 Days identified at least 82 people who died either living outside or sheltered in motels between 2021 and 2024. People die in largely invisible ways, in tents, sheds, motel rooms, and dumpsters. The majority of the deaths were from drug overdoses, but people are also hit by cars and die prematurely from natural causes. The cold alone hasn't killed homeless Vermonters in recent years, though some 2024 death certificates are still being finalized. But advocates worry that could change. Homelessness rates have spiked in Vermont, and the state's shelter system is maxed out. That's brought an urgency to efforts like Burlington's temporary emergency shelter.
Yeah. Jesse, you want to help gather some folks in the...
Yeah, let's do it. All right,
let's round them up.
Yeah, let's do it.
Back in Burlington on this frigid night, Sarah Russell and Taylor Tebow enlist Jesse Hillman, who camps in the city to help them round up people. Hillman led the social workers in the parking garage towards a stairwell where people often sleep. The door was locked. Hillman tried a different approach.
Anybody want to go to the warming shelter?
Last April, about 40 miles away from Burlington, Morristown Police Chief Jason Luno got a call around 9 p.m. There was a body in a shed next to a softball field. It was a small shed, about 10 feet by 15 feet. There was a mattress pad and some food inside. Luno recognized the dead man who appeared to be living there.
I mean, Michael is he was a local. He's been in our community, I believe, most of his life.
Luno had just seen Michael Malin the day before. He'd walked by while Luno was arresting a woman during a traffic stop. There was a dog in the car, and Malin offered to walk it to a family member in town.
And he actually took his belt off his pants and used it as the leash for the dog. And he took the dog because the vehicle was going to get towed.
Malin, who was 45, struggled with drugs and alcohol. He'd been in and out of prison for decades. His most recent stint had been for a month in 2022 after he'd absconded from parole. Shortly before that, he'd spent more than a year incarcerated after pleading guilty to aggravated domestic assault.
He was just, you know, he was fighting a substance abuse problem. He was unhoused.
Luno found a note in Malin's pocket addressed to his parole officer. He'd written it to prove that he'd tried to check in a few days earlier that week. Malin wrote that he hadn't been accepted into the state's emergency motel housing program.
I had only fallen into the adverse weather category, apparently, as if I don't need help getting a roof over my head with some sort of permanence in mind.
Malin continued,
the system is severely broken and not designed for successful reintegration of an inmate back into a successful way of life.
Luno says he found himself agreeing with Malin, that our system often sets people up to fail.
You know, here is a guy that had a pretty bad substance abuse problem, was on probation, and, you know, living in a shed.
Malin was not among the 25 Vermonters who were identified as homeless on their death certificates in the last 4 years. We used other clues on the form and additional reporting to confirm Malin's death and dozens more fatalities among people who appeared to be unsheltered or living in an emergency motel shelter at the time of their death. Getting an accurate count on how many people die while homeless is tough. Most states, like Vermont, don't track it.
So what we do know is it's a little complicated to collect all of the data.
That's Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine.
And then, of course, you get down to what is the definition of homeless? And is it a history of homelessness? Is it homelessness at the time the person expired?
Our reporting found that the majority of homeless deaths in Vermont were fatal drug overdoses. That's what killed Malin, the man in Morrisville. There were others. A 50-year-old man suffered a fatal overdose in a relative's backyard shed in Winooski, where he and his wife were staying last year. His widow died of an overdose 3 days later at a homeless encampment in Burlington. Among these dozens of people was a man I knew, Todd Gorton.
Hello, this is a prepaid call from
Todd Gorton,
an inmate at the Northern State Correctional Facility. To accept this call, press
I first
zero.
Met Gorton in 2021 while I was writing about how prisons were responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. Vermont was the only state in the country where no prisoners had died from COVID, thanks in part to aggressive lockdowns at prisons where the virus was detected. Gorton told me these lockdowns were tough. Once, he and his bunkmate were confined to their 8-foot by 12-foot cell for 49 days.
My anxiety is through the roof. I'm the best basket case you'll ever run into.
Over the course of 3 months, by phone and email, Gorton told me about his life. He'd spent most of it in prison, starting when he was 16. He was charged as an adult with attempted sexual assault and spent 3 years incarcerated. He did another 18 years after a 1990 conviction for sex crimes involving a child. When we talked in 2021, Gorton was close to finishing a 12-year sentence for burglary, but he was worried about finding a place to live.
I have no rental history. I have no private license. I've never even had a credit card. I've never had nothing, and nothing but jail. Nothing I ever had. I can't believe I made it this long.
Still, Gorton had some hope. He worked in the prison's wood shop and liked it. He thought maybe he could work in carpentry when he got out. I wish I could show you what I'm making, he told me once. He was also studying to get his commercial trucking license. At one point, he told me a friend found him an old Toyota camper he could live in, but he knew, whatever he did, some structure would help. Often in times of stress, he turned to drugs.
My problem is, though, every time I get out, I think it's my birthday, and it's not like that. I really got to do something with my life.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Well, I guess you know, I got to go.
Yeah. I'm glad you gave me a call.
It's almost count time anyway.
A year later, in May 2022, Gorton got out of prison. I lost track of him until last January when I ran into him at the Burlington Criminal Courthouse. The 54-year-old had picked up some retail theft charges. He'd been homeless and using drugs. But he told me things were looking up. He was on Suboxone and recently had gotten into Burlington's Housing Pods, a shelter intended as a first step for people exiting homelessness. I gave him my card and he said he'd call. Less than 2 weeks later, Gorton overdosed and died inside his 60-square-foot pod.
School bus or what, guys?
Basically. We're back in Burlington now. The bus for the emergency warming shelter is full. Sarah Russell, the city's special assistant to end homelessness, is behind the wheel.
Okay, everybody, I'm going to start driving.
Oh, board!
Guys, this was such a successful journey.
Russell turns the bus's heater on full blast. Some of the dozen or so people on the bus, like the man sitting beside me, were outside all day. The man told Russell that last night he tried to sleep in a car.
Just a little heater plugged in.
Our reporting did not find any unsheltered Vermonters who died due to exposure in the past 4 years. But advocates like Russell say that doesn't mean it's safe for people to be outside.
I feel like when people are like, well, if nobody's died, or people are like, oh, three people died, and it's like, I don't want to counter that and say, like, oh, well, they didn't die because they're outside, because of course that's a part of it.
Right down here.
Russell and Taylor Tebow, her co-pilot on the bus this evening, are walking towards several tents set up on Burlington's waterfront. We've already dropped off a busload of people at the temporary shelter and are back out looking for more.
It feels like we're in the, like, Arctic over here, right?
There is an urgency to Russell and Tebow's work tonight. Vermont's unsheltered homeless population is higher than it's been in a decade. There's less shelter capacity, too. Getting people inside, even if it's just temporary, could help prevent injury or death.
Hello, is anyone in here?
Russell approaches the tents. A bitter wind is whipping off the lake.
Hello? It's Sarah. Do you want to come in to the shelter?
No one answers.
It looks like there's a light on.
I know. That's where I'm like,
Russell like, crouches down. Tebow asks us to have a cell phone ready to call 911.
This is Sarah. I'm worried about you. I'm going to open the door.
No. Okay. 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 Nobody's in there.
No one was in the tent. While accidental drug overdoses account for the majority of deaths among homeless Vermonters, violent accidents also account for a handful of fatalities. In 2023, three people were crushed in dumpsters. There was a 67-year-old Rutland man and a 34-year-old mother of three from White River Junction. The third death was Sean Kelleher.
I was living on Crombie Street, and he was friends with my neighbors that lived across the street.
Jessica Barrows grew up with Kelleher in Burlington's Old North End. They weren't particularly close, but they ran in the same circles and would see each other over the years. In 2019, Kelleher needed a place to stay. Barrows, who'd moved to Hinesburg, said he could stay at her place. The two eventually started dating.
My happy times with him were normal days, like as I'm sitting in the kitchen doing dishes or cooking dinner. And, you know, that look where you catch each other staring, but you want to pretend that neither one of you were looking, you know, stuff like that.
But their relationship wasn't easy. Kelleher was an alcoholic. The 50-year-old had been in and out of prison for most of his life and was often homeless, sleeping outside or crashing at a friend's place. Sometimes, often after a fight, Kelleher would leave Barrow's house for the streets of Burlington.
Only one time it was longer than 3 months, but usually never more than a couple weeks to a month.
He was a part of my life in and out.
That's Kelleher's daughter, Marissa. She says her dad wasn't around much while she was growing up. He was often in prison. As an adult, she wouldn't hear from her dad for months or even years.
It's hard to see your parent in a light as an adult and think of them as a parent when you weren't raised with them. So it was more like, hey, I'm hanging out with this guy that has the same DNA as me.
June 2023 was another one of those times when Kelleher disappeared to Burlington. He and Barrows got in an argument. It didn't seem unusual to Barrows when he didn't call or come back to Hinesburg after a few days. Then, one morning, Barrows was watching the news.
Update now to the man found dead at a Williston recycling facility last week. Today, police aren't saying who he is. Williston police say 50-year-old Sean Kelleher was
said
found-
Sean Keller, and I didn't hear the rest. The body found in the, I remember the headline said, Burlington man's body found. And I remember, I heard it, and I had to rewind it because I have DVR. So I could get the number to where to call.
Workers found Kelleher's mangled body a few days earlier on the conveyor belt at Casella's Williston recycling facility. Police identified Kelleher using his tattoos, but they couldn't find any next of kin. That's why they put his name on the news. Barrows says she's struggled since Kelleher died. She, too, is a recovering drug addict and formerly homeless. After Kelleher died, she said she started using again, fell behind on her bills, and almost lost her housing.
Something just told me one day, you know, this isn't helping. Sean wouldn't want this. Something woke me up and was like, okay, we got to get this fixed. And I did. I eventually fixed everything. It took about 4 or 5 months to get the bills back where they're normal sized.
Marissa, Kelleher's daughter, says her grief has been complicated.
I didn't cry right off because it's hard to miss someone that you're used to living without. But I can say that once it hit me and the realization, I don't think that I cried because I missed him. I think I cried because of the potential relationship that we could have and that we didn't have that option anymore.
Marissa held a memorial for her dad about a month after he died. It was a small event, just some family and one of her dad's close friends. They brought his ashes to the Burlington waterfront and then dropped off care packages to the local homeless shelter. It's past midnight in Burlington. After dropping off 14 people earlier in the night, Sarah Russell and Taylor Tebow found a few more people downtown who wanted a ride to the emergency shelter. They'd have 82 people total stay there on this night.
All right, guys, I'm moving the bus now.
They had one more stop, Battery Park, right next to the police station. In the middle of the park, there's a large concrete-covered stage. A man was camping there, and earlier this evening, he told Russell he needed water. Russell parks the bus and walks over with two bottles of water.
Hey, Dad, are you sure I can't get you to come with me?
The man shakes his head no. He's sitting under a pile of blankets and sleeping bags.
I'm going to come out and check on you again tomorrow night, okay? Can I bring you something? Do you want food?
Hand warmers and gloves, the man says.
You want gloves? You want? Okay, I can bring you some gloves tomorrow.
Sometimes people reject the offer of a warm bed and shower. They're accustomed to being overlooked, ignored, or mistreated, and it's a leap of faith to believe someone like Russell will actually help them. That's why efforts like the bus are important, Russell says.
You know, it is. It's that balance of being like, we really do want you to come. I really want you. Because you saw, like, the more times we came down, you know what I mean? It's like people the first time that were like, oh, I don't know. And then the second time you come down and they're like, okay, yeah, you know? So I think it's like warming them up and having them feel like wanted, you know, and cared for.
But either way, Russell says she can at least give someone gloves and water.
The two reporters who worked on this story are joining us for the rest of the hour. Derek Brower of 7 Days, whose work focuses on law enforcement and the courts. Derek, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And Liam Elder Connors, Vermont Public's senior reporter on public safety. Liam, thanks for being here.
You bet.
And listeners, we would love to hear your responses to this story that we just heard. What feelings came up for you as you were listening? Are you involved in organizations that we heard from in the story, like People's Kitchen? If you'd like to share, we have space for you. Give us a call at 800-639-2211 or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. In a way, this story seems to me like
It is a story about lack. There's a lack of resources to permanently house all Vermonters. There is a lack of understanding about the lives of many people who are unhoused. And there's a lack of data about them. Liam, why did you all first decide to start looking into homeless deaths?
I think in a lot of what you described is the lack of information and understanding is part of it. And we're in this moment right now in Vermont where homelessness has increased dramatically over the last couple of years. And right now we're at a time when unsheltered homelessness, so people potentially living outside in tents, living rough, has increased quite a lot and is at pretty high levels. And so the risks to people in that situation is higher. And we want to have a better understanding of what those risks are and what they look like. And what it's like for the lives of those people and how the state could respond to that now that we're seeing more people. And so what we're trying to do is begin counting that number. You know, deaths is a very dramatic thing to look at, and also one of the most serious consequences potentially of living outside and being homeless, which is something that research has shown is dangerous for people and not good for their health. So trying to look at that is one way of trying to quantify the risks that are out there for an increasing number of Vermonters.
Hmm. And
yeah, Eric. I mean, I just, for me personally, I was just really surprised that that Vermont does not track this, but also that Vermont, it turns out, is not unique in failing to track this information, that the United States as a whole does a really poor job of counting mortality and deaths among homeless people. So, but as we looked into that, you know, why that is, it seemed like, well, there actually are ways to count this. And our count is by no means, I think, comprehensive, but it's a start, and it helps make these risks and challenges feel a little bit more concrete and real, I think.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how you collected all this data. One response to your reporting that we received just said, wow. You looked through death certificates in all Vermont towns. It's interesting that nobody has been tracking this. Have you considered going back a few more years to be able to compare pre-pandemic numbers? Let's put that question on ice for just a second. First, Derek, can you tell us a little bit about how you collected all this data?
Yeah, I mean, the state actually keeps track of death certificates from all the towns. So there is a central place to get them. But you know, so we were able to get a you know, big spreadsheets with everyone who died in the state, and then started looking for clues on those documents. For some people, a medical examiner, whoever fills out a death certificate, writes under where the person lived that they were homeless. But what we found is that most of the time, actually, they are not being recorded as homeless on the death certificate, because whoever is filling it out, it's not really their job to investigate and figure out, get to the bottom of somebody's residential status. And so sometimes they'll just put the last known address or whatever a family member tells them. But there were other clues on these documents that Liam and I were able to use to try to find some people who you might miss using that method. And we ended up finding, you know, nearly 60 more people that way in recent years who were homeless at the time they died. But there are reasons to believe, too, that we didn't find everybody. I mean, if somebody died in a hospital, for instance, and was not listed as homeless on the death certificate, it would be really hard for us to find that. So we know there are more. Know there are more out there as well. One other thing that's worth noting, I think, that there is some better data that we found some academic researchers have actually encouraged states to take a look at, that there are better ways to count this. For instance, mainly nonprofit homeless service providers keep track of all of their clients. These are confidential databases, but they have lists of people who have utilized these services. And if you were able to access that database and cross-reference it with death certificates, the state could come up with better numbers than Liam and I were able to, but that would take work, and it's sensitive data, and it's something the state hasn't tried to do.
Yeah. This person also asked if you've considered going back even farther than you did. The data you collected covers the years 2021 through 2024. Liam, have you thought about any comparisons to pre-pandemic numbers?
I mean, I think that's something that is really interesting to both of us. The caveat, though, and I think when we were looking at this project, is that our data is really kind of soft, is how I would describe it, and kind of messy because of the reasons Derek described, where, you know, we know that we're missing some number of people. And I think we're both hesitant. I know I'm hesitant to do a real deep data analysis before we can feel a little bit more confident in that we're not missing large numbers of people, or just can feel a little bit more confident that we have understood the universe a little bit more. I think it would be really interesting to look at the pre-pandemic and the post-pandemic, or at least post-2020 numbers, as homelessness rates have increased, and see if there's any difference in also causes of death or sort of what the risks are for people. But again, it sort of comes down to, can we feel like we have captured the universe more completely before we can do that? That's my sense, at least.
Yeah, I think just to add briefly, I think the commenter makes an important point, which is that the period of time we covered is actually a very, it's in many ways unique time in Vermont history, in which the state saw a surge in homelessness, but also did a really good job of sheltering homeless people. And one of the reasons why we wanted to report on this now is because, as you mentioned at the beginning, this issue of lack, we are at this kind of pivot point in the state where the state's ability or interest in housing the number of homeless people that it has is waning. And so we're entering kind of territory that we haven't seen in many years in Vermont, of seeing many more people living out on the street where they face the risks that we tried to explore.
Another person wrote to us to say that this story is sad but paints a perfect picture of homelessness in Vermont. I am a community health worker with UVM Home Health and Hospice, they write. Two of my clients are homeless. Both are medically vulnerable and would surely die if unsheltered. I appreciate this story and hope it reaches far and wide. Safety and warmth are not luxuries. They are human rights. Let's go to the phones. We have Sue calling in from North Bennington. Sue, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hi, Sue. Can you hear us?
Hello. Sorry. Yes, I can. I just had to get my phone out of my pocket. I was in my car.
No problem.
So
go ahead.
I'm calling from Bennington. I'm retired from work with people in poverty. I've been retired for 5 years, but I actually, as the program was airing, was on my way and am now at a homeless warming place. We're not calling it a shelter. That was opened by my church last week. And we have done this because we've worked for 20 plus years in Bennington trying to come up with a solution for emergency housing. And we've just never had it. So one of the things that really struck me about the article was the fact that the focus, you know, was on the top of the state. I'm sure that you looked at data down here, but you do have a shelter in Burlington, which is more than what we have here in Bennington. I did want to speak from my experience about tracking down deaths that occur outside to people who are homeless. In my experience, I know at least 5 people that I can think of off the top of my head who died outside during my time at a local anti-poverty organization. I don't believe that any of them had as their cause of death homelessness. One person who the public was very, very aware of died very tragically outside in the cold, and I believe it was a very medical diagnosis that they, you know, attributed his cause of death to. I find that outrageous.
Sue, would you be able to share the name of your church or where this warming place is in case people listening might be in need?
Absolutely. So we've just started it this past week. It is the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington. We are a very small congregation, but we've opened a warming place 2 afternoons a week, and we had immediate success last week with our first 2 openings, attracting guests. We're here to provide a warm place to sit for a few hours, to have a hot drink, to get some dry socks or boots or whatever, have a bathroom to use. One heartbreaking story, the first day we were open was a young woman who came in and asked if it was okay if she got washed up in the restroom. And I said, of course, we have some towels. And she went in and she came out and she had put on makeup.
And she said, I want you to know how much it means to me that I went in, I came in here feeling lousy and I can leave feeling pretty.
Oh, Sue, well, thank you so much for sharing these stories from your work and the resources available down in Bennington. Liam, Sue mentioned correctly that much of the storytelling in this piece takes place in Chittenden County, where you both are based and where I believe the majority of people who are unhoused in Vermont live. Is that correct?
It's not actually the majority of unhoused people, but certainly the numbers in the Burlington area are quite high. I mean, I think some of the stories we told were from other parts of the state, but we followed around these shelter workers who were trying to find enough space during a cold night in Burlington. But Sue pointed out a number of really useful and important things in her call there. But the lack of shelter in other parts of the state is a whole nother topic and a really critical one as well. I think one thing we did encounter in this too is that some of the smaller towns in Vermont are seeing people living outside. I mean, these are towns that maybe had nobody living outside before, and so there is much less infrastructure and experience even with this problem, and so the services aren't there.
Mm.
And I wanted to talk a little bit. I think Sue brought up another important point about the causes of death. She was describing, you know, people that she knew of that had died outside. And, you know, in our reporting, we didn't find that anybody died, that their cause of death was due to exposure or hypothermia. But we did find that it can be a little complicated too. We did find at least one instance where hypothermia was a contributing cause. But another example where a person who was living outside and didn't appear to have overdosed based on the toxicology, you know, they couldn't determine the cause or manner of his death, and he'd been living outside and it was very cold. So I guess one of the things that we're seeing is, you know, well, just because our data set, what we found or what we saw didn't show any hypothermia deaths, there's still a possibility that we're missing some of this, and that, you know, the cold is certainly can be a contributing factor and hurt people's health. I think that is one of the things that service providers and advocates told us through our reporting as well, that just because it's not necessarily on the death certificate isn't meaning that it didn't have some effect on a person's health or well-being.
I think it's worth pointing out too that the national level research that does exist on this has found consistently that experiences of homelessness shortens the lifespan. So I think when Sue is saying she's upset that homelessness isn't listed as a cause of death, I mean, it's a really hard thing to quantify, right? But it certainly contributes to quality of life and other conditions that can eventually lead to death for all kinds of reasons. I think one researcher we spoke with for the story did a recent study and found that people who were homeless who were homeless in 2010 ended up dying at more than three times the rate you would expect 12 years later. And the way they sort of phrased it was that if you were homeless at age 40, you had the same kind of life expectancy as somebody who was almost 60 years old who wasn't homeless.
Yeah. I just want to read a couple more messages from listeners here that we received since the story first came out in the middle of last week on both VermontPublic.org and on our airwaves and in 7 days in print and on your website. One person writes, this was a very enlightening article. You wrote this article without taking away dignity from people, and I think that's beautiful. I hope we can combat homelessness in the state of Vermont. Another person writes, thank you for writing this, and please don't stop. I have a son who is unhoused on probation with drug court. He, like others, needs housing first. It is unlikely that those mandated to attend drug court will make it without stable housing. To ask that of them, especially in lieu of long-term residential treatment, simply sets them up for repeated failure, despair, and shame. One listener wrote in to say that they appreciated your empathy, especially in a time when some news organizations are relying on artificial intelligence to write news stories. They write, I admire your work and your honesty about being human. I would hate to be reading the work of someone who did not respond as a human to the death of someone they have worked with. I do not look forward to reporters who have no human feelings and no human experience. This person is not into the fact that your story, Derek and Liam, tells the life stories of a number of different unhoused people. One of them was named Todd Gorton. Liam, you had met this person previously through your reporting. Could you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. So I had met Todd Gorton in 2025. I guess met is not really the right word since we had only talked on the phone. He was in prison at the time, and I was writing about how prisons in the state of Vermont were responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I wanted to talk to people who were in prison about their experience going through that, and because I thought that would be an important and enlightening story for the public to understand. And so I had met Todd then, and we actually talked a number of times over the course of about 3 months. And he told me a lot about his housing situation when he got out, which was that he didn't know what he was going to do because it's hard to find housing when you've spent most of your life in jail. Todd also had a conviction with a sex crime with a child conviction in 1990, which puts you on the sex offender list, and that also limits your housing ability to get housed in certain places. So he had a lot of complicated and you know, difficult aspects of his past. Long story short, when he got out of prison in 2022, I lost track of him and then ran into him about a year ago. He picked up some more crimes, and I saw him at the courthouse. And he unfortunately died a short time after I met him again of an overdose when he was in a shelter. And, you know, we wrote about Todd just because that is, you know, an example of struggles that a number of people who have been unhoused face, which is in and out of the criminal justice system, can limit the ability to find housing, make it more difficult. Obviously, Todd had a difficult past and some pretty serious convictions, but a lot of people, not everybody, but a number of people who struggle with housing insecurity and homelessness also have that experience. And so I think it helps to try to understand the people who are in those places if we're writing about homelessness and not to not write about it, I guess.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have David calling in from Isle LaMotte. David, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I'm a retired person and do a lot of volunteer work, but I have a lot of time on my hands and wondering where would I go to find the resources that might point me in the direction where I can best use my volunteer time and effort.
Thank you, David. Derek, any ideas for him?
Geez, you know, David, I'm not sure exactly where you should go here, but you'll want to find specifically up on the islands. You know, I'm not as familiar with the resources up there, but I think the state does have a list of organizations that do this kind of work on the Agency of Human Services website. But do you know anything else, Liam?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about there are a number of anti-poverty organizations throughout the state. You know, like Capstone is one that comes to mind, and that's in Lamoille County. And I believe all counties have some anti-poverty nonprofits in them. One thing you could ask your, you know, town officials. You know, I'm sure this is something that they're familiar with, and if they don't know exactly who is doing that in your region, they would be able to direct you to someone that knows. But sorry, I don't have a direct or specific answer for you there.
Yeah, well, thank you, David, for your interest. You two also talked extensively to Sarah Russell, who is Burlington's special assistant to end homelessness. And when people hear that title, they might assume that, you know, she's sitting at a desk all day and planning with other city leaders. But as we heard in this story, she is doing much more. She's hitting the streets, trying to talk to people who are experiencing homelessness and help them access care. Derek, first, could you tell us a little bit more about what her job entails? Because it's rather unique to Burlington.
Yeah, she was hired in 2022. And at that point, the former Mayor Murrow Weinberger was optimistic that the city could end homelessness by the end of 2024. And obviously, it's gone the other direction since then. But I mean, her work, as I understand it, was intended to be largely at the kind of policy advocacy level and a lot of coordinating work. I know she works on at the county level with the coordinated entry system that is trying to get people connected to housing in a very coordinated and kind of methodical way. So she's doing a lot of things. But well, I think we were really struck by the fact that this person who is charged with working at a high level on this complicated issue is now having to figure out how to like order enough pizza to get to an emergency shelter that they stand up when the weather forecast says it's going to get dangerously cold. So I, to me, that sort of shows the way in which the state has fallen behind behind the ball on this issue and is now really working in this kind of emergency response mode in a way that's struggling to solve homelessness, right? But merely trying to help keep people alive and safe who are homeless. And she spoke to us about that. And in some ways, she said that, you know, the experience we were able to witness her do her work on driving this bus around at midnight at least felt sort of tangible and like it was some way to have a concrete impact at a time when it has just become so difficult to move people from a state of being unhoused into housing.
Hmm. Now, what was it like being out there on that bus and in the cold, tapping on people's tents, seeing if they wanted to come into someplace warm?
Yeah, it was a pretty striking experience. When we got downtown, it was past 11 p.m., frigid, both sub-zero wind chills, and there was literally nobody else on the streets except for people that didn't have a home to go back to. And it was really striking to sort of be in this desolate, cold, freezing place and to just watch Sarah and her colleague at the time, Taylor, just going up to people and saying, like, hey, do you need a warm place? Do you want a warm shower? And working to try to tell people and say, hey, we just want to keep you warm and safe. It was a pretty, I said this already, a striking experience, but it was very vivid and visceral in a lot of ways like that.
And it wasn't just a matter of going out there and doing it and offering the invitation to come. I mean, I think one thing I was somewhat surprised, or maybe shouldn't have, but to see the kind of patience that the work requires as well, that there are good or at least understandable reasons why some people were wary or reluctant to take them up on the offer, and so for me it was really interesting to hear these social workers, trained social workers, go out and have conversations with people and listen to them and in a way that they hope can build trust, and for some people. They had to manage their own expectations about this, that somebody may not take them up on the offer that night, but two nights later they may decide that it's worth it. So it's complicated work and hard work to do, and help me understand, I think, to force me to put myself in the shoes of somebody who is sleeping on the streets in a way that I that is sometimes hard to do.
Let's take another call. We have Peter in Montpelier, and Peter, we have just a few minutes left, so I'll ask you to be brief.
Surely, I'm calling because the Unitarian Church in Montpelier has had an overnight shelter from 8 to 8, staffed by volunteers since December 14th, and we've been open 30. Out of the last 50 days.
Wow.
And an average of 12 people a night come, and we offer cots and some food, but chiefly warmth and hospitality.
Peter, thank you for sharing that resource with us. We also have Sharon in Shoreham calling in. Sharon, go ahead.
Hi. I was just responding to the caller's name was David, and he's up in Grand Isle County.
Mm-hmm.
Was looking for some resources for volunteering. And if he calls 211, you know, Vermont 211, just dial 211, they can direct him to many resources where he can, you know, volunteer and help with this issue.
Mm. Thank you, Sharon. That's very helpful information. 211 for more information on volunteering in our region. Derek and Liam, As people have heard throughout this hour, this story was presented as a collaboration between two news organizations and told via print and radio storytelling. I don't want to get too navel-gazy about the journalism craft here, but I am wondering if you could address why you two wanted to work together on something like this and why it took efforts from two separate newsrooms to pull together this type of comprehensive storytelling. Liam?
Well, I like working with Derek. We've worked together on some other stories, and I think we've found that working together is an effective way to do more in a shorter period of time sometimes, but also to tackle projects that are ambitious, that are hard to do on our own. And with this one, there was a heavy lift in terms of gathering the death certificates and looking through them and getting police reports and making public records requests. And so doing that between two people just made sense.
Yeah, I think, too, you know, we wanted to publish this story while it was still really cold outside, too. And so there was a kind of urgency to it. And by working together, we were able to get through that reporting, all of the records requests and interviews to verify that people were homeless when they died. We were able to do that so much faster by teaming up. So that was kind of the chief benefit. But I think... I really enjoy the ability to the different strengths of both medium too, and to be able to both write about the characters in these scenes and then to be able to hear their voices too, just really from my perspective as a print journalist, really adds a lot to the storytelling. Mm-hmm.
Let me share a couple more messages that we received since these stories came out. One person wrote, "Thank you for your heartfelt, dedicated reporting. It really humanized folks struggling with homelessness and brought me to tears." Another person wrote, "Thank you for writing so clearly and compassionately about this. Most people do not understand the depths of human suffering directly related to living unhoused, nor understand their role in allowing this to continue by not insisting we provide housing for all. Housing First is critical. Please continue your work." Liam Elder Connors with Vermont Public and Derek Brower with 7 Days, thank you so much for joining me this hour and for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Michaela.